All right, we are in Parshas Noach. We're going to finish up Parshat Noach today. You all read through to Lech Lecha, which we will definitely start on Wednesday. This will only help. We're really talking about the end of Noach as the end of Noach, but also as inherently the transition into Lech Lecha and Avraham. Taking a look back at what, just to quickly catch ourselves up in terms of what we talked about so far, very much in a nutshell, we talked about, going all the way back to Bereshit, how Adam and Chava ate from the fruit. The eating of the fruit created an internalization of Tov and Ra and an intermingling of Tov and Ra. Over time, Ra won out. As we continued out through Parshat Bereshit, Ra overtook the world to a point where God said it's time to destroy the world. We looked at two different psukim, one before the flood, one after the flood, and we contrasted the language of Rak, Ra, Kol Hayom, that there's an entirety, an essence of Ra that can't be removed, of Rak, Ra, Kol Hayom, versus Ra mini'urav. And what we described was this process where the world was in a ni'urim stage, was in its youth stage, its adolescent stage, so to speak, and that stage is entirely comprised of Ra, in a way that a person needs to actively choose to move out of over time. It needs to be washed away with one's own internal flood to bring out all of the negativity, right? And then when one moves through that, or when the world moves through its ni'urim stage, when it wipes out all of that, then we can start the world anew. And that brings us around the middle of Parshat Noach, middle toward the end of Parshat Noach, to Perek Tet, Pasuk Yudchet, which is what we spent the last shir on, which were Shem, Cham, and Yefet. Because if the whole world is wiped out, and all we're left with is Noach, Misham Nafza Kol Ha'aretz, the Lashon was something like that, Shai Lebei Noach U'me'ila Nafza Kol Ha'aretz. So the whole world is going to come out from his children, which we described at length last time, just in the way that we described them last time. Actually, chronological order, Cham, Yefet, and Shem. We talked about how those three, Cham, Yefet, and Shem, have inside of them basically the genetic makeup, the identities from which all of the world will come forth. Cham, Milashon, Cham, or heat, passion, Chomer, Chomeriut, physicality, that overwhelming sense of physicality that's unable to be tamed. Yefet, external beauty without the internal content. And Shem, essence by essence, and that's why his name is Shem. And from there, those three are going, the whole world is going to come about. Now let's take a look, if we took a look at the rest of the Parsha from there on. From Perek Yud, Pasuk Aleph, until the end of the Parasha, let's break it down into three parts. What three parts do we break down the rest of the Parsha into, taking into account, as we always do, the Petuchot and Stumot? Take a look inside. From Perek Yud, Pasuk Aleph, to the end of the Parsha. There are really three distinct sections. The middle one is the clear division between the two.
Is there another question?
The Tower
of Babel. Where is that? Is that one, two, or three?
Two.
Two is Migdal Bavel.
Oh, so you asked for like the split.
What's happening in one and three?
The first is like his ancestry.
We heard ancestry and generations, which sound very similar. What's the difference between one and three? They look very similar. They seem very similar, but on critical analysis, they're not at all.
The first one is just the... The third one is to...
Nimrod.
It's to Abraham.
From what to Abraham?
From Noah to Abraham.
That's the Mishnah in Pirkei Avot, which says that there's 10 generations from Adam to Noach, which we saw at the end of Parshat Bereshit, and this is the 10 generations from Noach to Avram. This is our Asara Dorot from Noach to Avraham. That's our 10 generations. From Noach to Avraham is after Migdal Bavel. What comes before Migdal Bavel? We even began to talk about it in the last shiur.
The opposite.
Well, it's definitely taking us forward, but it's different. Excellent, Eliora. This is the Shiv'im Umot. If you can read that. These are the 70 nations. Meaning there's two totally different genealogies going on here. That's why we sat through them all this past Shabbat and we're wondering what was happening and why we had to do it twice. Right? There are two different processes happening here. In the first piece, Perek Yud, Pasuk Aleph, until Perek Yud Aleph, Pasuk Aleph, until through the end of Perek Yud, that's all the Shivim Umot. That's the world starting from Noach, going to Shem, Ham, and Yafet in the previous paragraph, and then the beginning of Pasuk Yud. It's the breakup, it's the individualization of those three individuals into the 70 core nations, the individualization of the 70 nations, the Shivim Umot, that are defined in reality. Those are the 70 core nationalities or identities in the world. And they all have to come from Noach, and by definition from Shem, Ham, and Yafet then as well. That's not taking us through one specific strain to get us from Noach to Abraham. This is one line in the genealogical tree that's very direct and intentionally getting us to Abraham. Those are two different things. Now, what's interesting about the order here? We have the Shivim Umot, Migdal Bavel, and then the Asara Dorot. How might you have thought to organize it differently?
First, the direct line, because it's direct, and then the whatever needs to branch out, even though they're on the same. Like, are they corresponding? The first and the third.
Two totally different processes. This gets us much later, much, much farther along, because it's discussing a totally separate process. Bachel?
I feel like it's going to be around forever. I feel like Migdal Bavel, then the 70 nations, and then Abraham, because that, like, ties it into the next part, but, like, you're like, going down from, like, Migdal Bavel, and then, like, 70 different nations, like, being funnily dispersed, and then you're going to Abraham.
Good, Eliora.
I think it makes sense the way it is. But you're talking about the 70 nations and you go into how they were dispersed. And then we said that this Bnei Israel is not part of the 70 nations, so we're going back to lineage. And that's when we're going into the next.
Good. So Eliora wants to keep it the way it is. Bashava wants to move Migdal Bavel, and Tibi wants to move Asara Dorot. So we have totally different places here. What did you want to say, Hannah?
I was going to agree with Bashava.
With Bathsheba, that you want to move Migdal Bavel.
Because the two, like, I feel like it just feels right that the generation should be near each other.
Okay.
Not like with the interruption, like, Migdal Bavel.
Think about it a little bit more deeply. What's happening in Migdal Bavel?
Is when the 70 nations are broken.
So where would you want Migdal Bavel?
First.
You want Migdal Bavel up there. Meaning, if you think about it for a second, when you think about the content of Migdal Bavel, when you think about the content of Migdal Bavel, the Tower of Babel, what's happening? If we take a look inside the text in Perek Yud Aleph, Vayihi kol ha'aretz safa achat udvarim achadim. The whole land was one language and of one purpose, of one identity. Right? They were all one. The division of the 70 nations, which become 70 languages, 70 identities, that's a direct result of Migdal Bavel. So in fact, the order here is strange. What we would have to assume then is that what the Torah is doing is explaining to us how it goes from Noach to Shem, Ham, and Yefet, and then continues on to show us sort of what Elior was listening to, which is, it's the natural extension of Shem, Ham, and Yefet to see the Shivim Umot HaOlam. And then the Torah questions and says, okay, but how did we get to 70 distinct identities and cultures? How did that happen? Through what mechanism? The story of Migdal Bavel, the story of the Tower of Babel. That's the story that divides up that unified world into those 70 distinct identities that we just previously identified. The Torah is not concerned with chronology. It's, if you want to use the Lashon of Ein Mukdam U'Meuchar Batorah, theoretically you could. The idea there being, when we say that there's no such thing as chronology organizing the Torah, it doesn't mean that the Torah is random, as some say it means. It means rather that while we often superficially think that the only way to logically organize things is through chronology, there can be deeper systems of organization, more meaningful systems of organization than chronology. And so here we trace the root of all people in Noach through the dispersion and the spreading out of the 70 nations that come out of him. And then we explain, how did we get there? That's Migdal Bavel. How did we get there? Migdal Bavel takes us on that journey to get to those 70 nations. Let's unpack Migdal Bavel for a moment. Migdal Bavel is a very significant story in terms of getting us to Lech Lecha and Avram Avinu. Who is it that's running Bavel at the time? Who is the king of Bavel during the story of the Tower of Babel, during the story of Migdal Bavel?
Is it Nimrod?
So it's not as explicit. You have to pull together a few psukim. But if you take a look in Perek Yud, Pasuk Chet. Perek Yud Pasuk Chet. V'chush yalad et Nimrod. Chush gave birth to Nimrod, not surprisingly coming from Cham. He began to be this very strong person in the land. He was a hunter. And therefore it was said, like Nimrod, a great hunter before God. But he reshit mamlachto, Bavel. His first kingdom, his initial kingdom is Bavel. So when we talk about Migdal Bavel, we're really talking about the kingdom of Nimrod. What do we know? It's certainly from a Chazal level. Who is the antithesis of Nimrod? Who is the arch nemesis of Nimrod?
Abraham.
So what we're watching now is, not only Migdal Bavel is discussing to us the dispersion of the world into 70 nations of unique identities, but whatever Migdal Bavel is, whatever is at the root of the issue of Migdal Bavel and Nimrod is going to set the stage for Avraham to emerge on that contrasting background. Avraham is whatever Migdal Bavel and Nimrod is not. He's the opposite. When we see the Tower of Babel fall, then we can trace our Asara Dorot, our 10 generations from Noah to Avraham, and actually have Avraham emerge. He's emerging out of the fall of Migdal Bavel. Now the question is, what is Migdal Bavel all about? So let's come back to that same pasuk that opens up Migdal Bavel. Questions until this point? Yeah, Elior.
So how did you say, how did you explain how the 70 nations come before Migdal Bavel?
So I think it's just taking us all the way through logically from Noah into three, if you will, from Noah was the root into, I guess, the three branches, and then the 70 leaves.
Okay.
Right?
And then something...
All of those leaves relating back to their original branch, as we talked about last year. Then it says, okay, fine, but how did we get there? We got there through the mechanism of Migdal Bavel, which sets the stage for the emergence of Avraham, which brings us to Lech Lecha. Everything here is very intentional. Everything here is telling us a narrative if we look deeply enough. Other questions? Thoughts? Good. Okay. First pasuk of Migdal Bavel is Perek Yud Aleph Pasuk Aleph. Vayihi chol ha'aretz safa achat udvarim achadim. The whole land was one language and of one purpose or a common purpose or a common unity. This opening paragraph tells us what the generation of Migdal Bavel was all about. What does that remind you of? What type of society is the description of the society of Migdal Bavel? Right, so first of all, if you've ever taken a utopia course in literature, it's usually followed by another word.
Communism?
Oh, communism is what I was going to get to, but utopia and dystopia. Meaning, utopias and dystopias usually are just a hairline away from each other. So it sounds theoretically utopian, but God certainly didn't think so. God takes them down. God seems to have a problem with that. Let's take a look inside if you want. Pasuk hey. God says, "Hein am echad usfara achat luchulam luchulam v'zeh hachilam lasot." They're all of one purpose, and this is what they do. Right, and now should it not be withheld from all that they propose to do? Meaning, God is unhappy with this supposed utopia, which is more likely to be a dystopia. And that's actually a common theme in literature. What was the... This utopia, or utopian society, where everybody's of one language, one purpose, we would think that achdut would be good. Hashem echad u'shmu echad. One purpose, unity, seems to be a good thing in Judaism. We believe in essence of one. This type of unity seems to not have worked.
It's the opposite of what
Correct. Well, that's definitely true if God is tearing it down, and if it's going to produce Abraham. Right? So the question is, what was wrong with it? And there was another word that was used a second ago, which I think sort of, my Rebbe also uses this, although he lived through it and I certainly didn't. What was the word that you used before in terms of what this society seems to be like? Communistic society. The idea of Migdal Bavel is a sense of, well, let's phrase this as a question. Right? What makes a communist society go from looking like a utopia to actively being a dystopia? What doesn't work with a utopian society? What doesn't work with a utopian society? What doesn't work with a communist type of situation?
So when people like work harder, let's say, and they get the equal amount of, I mean, I'm thinking of pay, so I can't think. I don't. Let's say like, meaning, let's say like somebody's a doctor and somebody
compensation.
Compensation. Meaning people will slack off. But, like if you're a doctor or a garbage man, and you're living the same lifestyle, one person's either not working harder in later hours, that doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I don't know how
to
really
love
that, but like compensation.
Okay,
say.
Good.
Also, I don't really know so much about communism, but isn't it like the whole idea that like everyone's like the same? So like they're saying like, oh, let us do this, like they said to each other. So maybe got to a point where it wasn't that it was they, it was one person was on top of other people. It wasn't really unity anymore.
Interesting. The indication of the text, unlike actually, like, communist Russia went down, was not that there was one person on top and that was the problem, but the actual unity itself was problematic. Tippy.
Well, starting with the same sentence, you started, everyone's the same, so then maybe they thought they were the same as God, because everyone's the same, so
interesting.
They resented that there was someone, something even over them. That's why they built the tower, to be like, no, we're equal.
Good. Marissa.
Kind of like, you learned a lot about this in anthropology and sociology about language and how it can reflect the way people think.
Mm-hmm.
So they all have one language and possibly they all think along the same way and there aren't any disagreements and different ways to think.
Interesting. Excellent. Let's keep Abram on the side, which we're going to do in a second anyway. We've got Migdal Bavel here. We had words like everyone is the same. And used a great phrase, groupthink. Basically, what happens when you have a situation where everybody is the same is there's no uniqueness, there's no individuality, there's no ownership of who you are. Everybody becomes subservient to the group. Everything becomes subservient to the whole. And what you end up with is a single mindset, a single mentality, a single way of looking at the world. You destroy any chance for individualization and also for individual responsibility. The goal of this world is not to simply fall back and blend into some larger group to the extent where you no longer have individual responsibility, where your individual nature is not emphasized. And Migdal Bavel was an attempt to bring the world together not as Hashem Echad Ushmo Echad, as a unification of one God or a revelation of the oneness of God, which we'll talk about over time, has to happen through each individual anyway, but rather a unity in a way where everybody is the same, everything is the same, we're all simply cogs in that machine, it doesn't matter who lives and who dies, it doesn't matter if when building Migdal Bavel somebody falls off, somebody else will take his or her place, because nobody matters. Nothing matters. When everything is the same, nothing matters. When everything is the same, nothing has significance. When everything is the same, there's no individual responsibility. When everything is the same, you can have groupthink, which is what you were talking about, Marissa. And when you have groupthink, which is beautiful, how you lift it to language, then everybody's thinking the same way anyway. I don't have to make any choices for myself. I just follow what everybody else is doing. Really, what it's doing, if you want to break it down into its essence, is removing the empty... What?
Did we learn that today?
Yeah.
No, I think we learned that today.
Oh, yeah?
Awesome.
Everything, HaKadosh Baruch Hu takes care of everything in... with Asher Kapati, what it removes is, one second, what it removes is, by creating that reality of groupthink, is it takes away perhaps the most fundamental aspect of humanity, which we've defined is Bechira Chofshit, or free choice. That's gone in a Migdal Bavel reality. That needs to be destroyed. Were you going to say, Tzivi?
Like, you said it takes away people's feelings, like if one person were to fall off, like, and someone else would just take their place, but the individual, they would have fear, let's say. They wouldn't want to fall off. They'd understand that they were going to die.
But the society doesn't care.
Yeah,
the mentality doesn't care.
That each individual, no one wants to fall off.
That individual may not, but they've put themselves into a system where their unique identity is meaningless. I can throw 100 soldiers in an army at a certain situation, and if they all get killed, I don't care, I'll find another 100. I could take another 15 people to go to the top and put in the next break. It doesn't matter if they fall off. It's me who's running the situation. I don't care if they fall off. I'll find another 15. And that was what happened in McDoubleville. There was zero interest in the individuals who were actually a part of the project, who are part of that unified society. As long as it got done, I don't care who it is. So the individual may care about him or herself from a selfish perspective, but the global mentality, the groupthink, the ideology, is all unified to an extent where it removes any care or any sense of that individual person. Other thoughts or questions? So Migdal Babel has to get torn down. And through that, God, using, as we mentioned before, his Hashkacha Pratit, in terms of the way that he wants to guide history, he then uses that as the opportunity to divide the world into its 70 nations. Its 70 individualistic, unique composite parts. Totally the contrast of what Migdal Babel is about. It's the dispersion of Babel that creates the 70 nations, that creates that paradigm, that forces each one into its own unique individual national identity. That's the whole idea of what Babel is, and Babel becomes for all generations. Babel milashon mivulbal, to mix up. And we see Babel being at the heart of many mixing ups over the course of history. Where else does Babel come up in that sense?
We're exiled,
we're dispersed from Babel. We put together the Talmud Bavli, which on the surface looks like a whole jumble of different things, which we have to figure out how to organize. But the idea of Mivulbal, the idea of things getting mixed up, are all coming out of Babel and going to these 70 nations. And this is something which I mentioned last time, and I apologize, I know it was not as clear as it should have been, about the significance of that 70, not necessarily giving it content, but at least building it up a little bit more strongly. There are a few systems of 70 that we're familiar with. We have here the Shiv'im Umot, the 70 nations. What other systems of 70 do we have?
70 Zekanim.
Good. 70 Zekanim. That's 70 Zekanim. What else? Similar.
70 names of Hashem.
Good. I'm going to leave that out for a second. More simply.
Languages.
That's going to come back to the 70 nations, which are going to be linked to language, correct?
Isn't there the Sanhedrin
with 70? Good. Does it can lead to a system of the Sanhedrin being a system of 70 as well? What else, even before these two stages, do we have a system of 70, even in Sefer Bereshit?
People who came down.
Yeah,
people can 71. Bnei Yaakov. There's 70 people. There are 70 individuals who go down to Egypt once our own nation is built. But what's unique about all of these scenarios is that 70 seems to be that elemental number that we're not going to pour content into yet. I'm not sure exactly what it means to begin with. But 70 is that elemental number. But it's not just 70. What is it, 70? It's 70 plus?
One.
So what do we have with the Zekanim? It's the 70 plus
Moshe.
When we have this measure, it's 70 plus the Av Beit Din. When we have the Bnei Yaakov, it's 70 plus Yaakov. It's always a system of 70 with one at the center that rises above, with one at the center that's the center point of those things. Which is very interesting. Rabbi Ravanos pointed out in his shir on this as well, that in an earlier form of Hebrew, the actual way that you would write this, what's the letter, the corresponding letter to the number 70?
Seven.
Ayin. So an ayin was actually drawn like this, a circle, with a dot in the center.
Oh.
In ancient Hebrew, that was actually the symbol for the number 7. Yeah.
Also, was the setup of the Sanhedrin, how was that with, like, someone in the middle and then around that? Or is that, are we getting confused?
I'm not. I have to double check.
Okay.
Is a circle with a dot in the center. Is that emergence of 70, that idea of that circle with one emerging from the totality of the whole. What else, if we're talking about the structure, 70, the letter, what else comes to mind if you're looking at this? What letter is 70?
Ayin.
What does I mean?
Ayin.
Somebody, something looking like the structure of the eye as well. A circle with something at the center points. And somehow that being the correct way to go forward, to see, to take things in. There's clearly a lot happening here. There's a lot unfolding into each other. But the point is, we saw that a 70 is Moshe, is Moshe and the Zekanim, is the Abetin and the Sanhedrin, is Yaakov and his children who go down to Egypt. What are we missing here with our 70 nations?
Hashem's name, Bnei Israel.
Who's going to be embodied by, in this case?
Abraham,
right? That's where we're going. We have the individual. We see from Migdal Bavel and the fall of Migdal Bavel the individualization of nations, from which we then have to sift through over the course of 10 generations from Noach all the way down. The way that the Midrash puts it, I wasn't able to find it in Medrash Rabba. It's not that it is there. My friend says it's there. It's there. I wasn't able to find it to quote it directly from you, for you. But the way that the Midrash Rabba puts it, either the end of Parshat Noach or the beginning of Parshat Lech Lecha, that over the course of the 10 generations from Adam to Noach, and then from Noach to Abraham, it's as though the king sent his advisors to go and slowly but surely sift through the sands of history, seeking and searching for its pearl, searching for the crown jewel, for the pearl that was lost. And that pearl that emerges once we've individualized the nations and we've got our 70, the emergence of the 71st is going to be Abraham. And that's how Abraham emerges. That's the end of Parshat Noach. Brings us Abraham. It forces Abraham out by taking us from Noach to Shem, Ham, and Yefet to the 70 nations to Abraham. But we skipped over Migdal Bavel. Because Migdal Bavel also defines what the content of Abraham needs to be, who he is, what he's about. What is Abraham all about when he emerges? What's the contrast to Migdal Bavel? Good. Abraham Ha'ivri. What's a good, what's, give me some English words or other Hebrew words.
He had like a different school of thought than
it was. It was a small school.
Small school. A one person.
Yes. But that's the idea. He is the presentation of an individual who totally steps aside, selects himself out, becomes the individual. Abraham is the prime individual of history, who, looking at a whole world who sees things differently than him, he looks at the entire world and he asks questions critically. He doesn't go with groupthink. He doesn't go with everybody else doing the same thing. He looks at the world critically and he says, I don't understand. Why are you bowing down to idols? If I can push them over and smash them, if I can create them with my own hands, how are they idols? If fire can put out water, or water can put out fire, how are those gods? Somebody who looks at the group thing and says, I'm not going to accept what you say just because everybody believes it. I have a command on myself. I have an innate sense that I'm here with my ability to choose, my ability of free choice, my ability to see the world, I suspect. My Rebbe didn't say this, but if we're going to talk about how an ayin looks like an ayin, the emergence of a 71st, the ability to look critically at the world and be decisive, as is in these other cases, the Sanhedrin and the Zekanim, you need the 71st to not allow there to be an equal split, to be the decisive critical eye to make the choice of what the truth really is in the world. To have Avram with that discerning eye to look clearly at what is happening in the world around him and to stand totally on the other side. Avram ha'ivri, me'aver lanahar. The whole world is standing on one side of the river and he brings himself le'aver to the other side of the river and stands there alone saying, I don't care that I'm the only one over here, right? Ali, I don't care that I'm the only one in that school. If I believe it's right, it's where I'm going to stand. If it's what the world is screaming out is the truth, that's where I'm going to stand. I'm going to deeply seek truth in this world and try to find it and try to live it. That's the essence of Avraham. That's the birth of Avraham Avinu. That's the emergence on a text level of Avraham Avinu. Avraham ha'ivri, Avraham the individual. And what are the first words then, reflective of Avraham himself, that are said by God to Avraham? Lech lecha, go to yourself. Keep following that journey, keep following that path to who you really are. Don't let anything else define you. Lech lecha me'artzecha, umi'ulatzecha, me'meitavicha. Leave behind everything. Leave behind the unity. Leave behind the groupthink. Leave behind the things that are claiming to define you. And find who you are from the inside out. Define yourself from the inside out. It's an incredible charge to all of us, and we'll be unpacking Lech Lecha for the next couple of weeks. But it's an incredible charge to all of us. Each of us, as the children of Avraham Avinu, as Bnei and Benot Avraham, all of us who have the genes of Avraham inside of us, igniting our Avraham genes mean taking a critical look at the world and finding God in the world on our own. Not letting anybody define it for us. Not our parents, not our society, not our culture, not our secular college classes, not the person who's standing in the front of the room in a midrasha. It's about taking a critical look at the world around us and with guidance, with help, asking critical questions, which may have answers. Avraham's questions did not have any good answers. But asking questions, deeply seeking our own facet of that ultimate truth. That's an incredible charge. That's the charge of Lech Lecha. That's the charge of Bnei Menot Avraham, yeah.
Ultimately, it comes down to faith in the case of Judaism. So what makes the difference here?
It's not just about faith. The Rebbe puts it, he is somewhat critical of parts of the Torah world that are very accepting of, meaning people, I guess you call them, you know, we colloquially call FFBs, people who are from birth, that just because a person is doing everything right, quote unquote, just because they're following all of halacha, the Torah doesn't exempt them from being their own Avraham, doesn't exempt them from going on their own personal search and journey and making Torah really meaningful for themselves also. There has to be a search for individual meaning. There has to be a search. You could come right back around to the same conclusion, but there has to be a search that brings you to your own meaningful internal conclusion. So there is faith involved in terms of... Faith is also a complicated word. We're going to talk about emunah. Not this year, unfortunately. We'll talk about emunah more deeply when we get into those issues in Sefer Shmot. But emunah is not all that it appears to be. And it's not just about blind faith. It's about making Judaism meaningful to us in such a way that even when I don't feel or see God clearly manifest in my life, I will remain faithful to Him and He will remain faithful, and I believe that He will remain faithful to me. It's a totally different type of take on emunah. It's about dedication and faithfulness more than blind faith.
But let's say you could either follow along and not go through this process of questioning, or else what if you were to go through this process of questioning and that caused you to go astray from Judaism? What's better? I mean, you're supposed to go through the process of questioning, but what if you don't come out with the right answers?
I would question the extent to which a person had any security in the first place if the moment they start searching, they find answers that draw them so far away from where they thought they were. The search is integral to who we are. We're all expected to be an Avraham Avinu. Not in a way, again, I think it's important that everybody, before they go on a dangerous journey through treacherous territory, picks a good tour guide. Somebody who's going to understand your limitations, your strengths, your weaknesses, know how much water and food you're going to need, know how many breaks you're going to take, each individual on their own, and help guide you individually through that process to help you find your own truth, hopefully, and if it's really truth, within Torah and within Judaism. But to not go on that journey is a big question as to whether or not we're living up to our potential. That we'll get into really deeply in Sefer Devarim, but that's long after, unfortunately, many of you will probably be around who kept it on the internet. But that's very much Devarim-oriented things. At the end of days, each person seeking out God on his or her own, which is emphasized by the text there. But the goal is to get there on our own. The goal is to, again, pick a good guide. I'm not saying Chas v'Shalom to... I'm not recommending to everybody, you know, ditch the Midrashah, go to your comparative religion classes and check it out first, and if you still think it's good, come back. We can explore Judaism within the context of a Midrashah also, if we're open and honest, if we're teaching both Rambam and Ramchal at the same time, which are two totally different worldviews, and that's why we try to switch out the worldviews even in the Hashkafah section. There's also exploring within the system and the different facets of the system itself. I'm not saying you have to throw everything away. I'm saying that making sure to critically think and analyze who you are, what you are, and what your Judaism means, that's what it means to be an Avraham, and I strongly believe what every one of us is expected to do, on our own level, in our own way. Tov? Any other questions, thoughts, comments, personal journeys? Maybe the last one should have been yes, but okay. Tov. So with that, that brings Parshat Noach to a close and really sets the stage for Parshat Lech Lecha, and on Wednesday, things get really crazy as we get to Parshat Lech Lecha.